listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And our telephone number is 866-987-THOMS, 866-745-CONS. If you want to call and argue with me, if you're online. Dan Gaynor, by the way, is going to come on and argue with us today. He wants to... Actually, it's going to be an interesting conversation. Gotcha journalism. James O'Keefe has raised gotcha journalism to a whole new level. So we're going to see where that goes. And a lot of the news today, which we will be getting to, not the least of which is the Republican plan to destroy democracy. It's really, in my mind, that simple. And turn this country into a 15th century oligarchy. John Nichols, on the ground, in Wisconsin. The Washington editor for The Nation, also writes for the Cap Times there in Madison. And John, you need a johnnichols.com or something like that website, John.
No, I got The Nation site, and I got Tom Hartman's show. Come on. Okay. What better platform would anybody ask?
You do such great work, though. John Nichols, what's going on in Wisconsin? I'm hearing all sorts of weird stories. Was the release of the emails last night? I realize it was like the equivalent of a FOIA release, but was this an attempt by Walker to, or was it being spun as an attempt by Walker to simply grab the news cycle or make it look like he's trying to compromise when he's not? And why was there absolutely, in none of the coverage I saw of it, any mention whatsoever, and there continues to be almost no mention, of the fact that the biggest piece of this bill is that Wisconsin gets to sell off all its public utilities to the Koch brothers?
Well, with all due respect, I'm going to challenge you on that. I think the biggest piece of this bill, while the Koch brothers thing is the, you know, it's like the icing on the cake, I believe the biggest piece of this bill is actually the payout to the insurance companies, or the payback to the insurance companies, with the consolidation of the power in the governor's office and his ability to radically restructure Medicare, Medicaid, Badger Care, Senior Care, and that's involving 400,000 people.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And
all right, I stand corrected.
No, I'm not. You know, you may be right.
I mean, this is really all the same thing. It's like, let's turn government over to big corporations and rich people and let them run it and let them own it.
And let's do something else. And it's amazing, in a sense, the Republican legislators so far have gone along with this. Let's also deal the legislature out of this process.
Right.
Because this restructuring of power into the governor's office that several dozen new czars appointed, basically the elimination of traditional cabinet form of government, means that the legislature has oversight ability on cabinet. It doesn't really have any oversight ability on these several dozen new czars that will be created.
Well, what we're seeing in Michigan is the right of the governor to simply dissolve a city, you know, a school, anything from a school district to a city, if he decides it's in a crisis, and appoint Halliburton to run it. I mean, literally. And down in Florida, you got Rick Perry, basically doing something very similar, creating czar-like positions in his state. I mean, this seems to be a very consistent Republican mantra or meme or theme or something.
Well, it is. And think of this, because, you know, George Bush said it best. And you know, we should always recall his wise statements. George W. Bush. It's good to be the king.
Yeah.
Right?
It would be a heck of a lot easier if this was a dictatorship, just so long as I'm the dictator.
That's exactly right. And the 2010 election, this is how to understand this, Tom. We slow it all down and we just look at reality. The 2010 election gave them kind of a lucky break. They got to be the king.
Right.
They had a wave election. It gave them, control of governorships and legislatures in a lot of key states. And so I actually don't know that they planned for this to happen now, you know, a year ago, that they were thinking, oh, this is what we're going to do. But they were smart enough, just as Karl Rove was. Remember, after 9/11, we know that day and the following days, Karl Rove moved immediately to look for political advantage out of a crisis. Well, I know that Republican think tanks and political players said, look, you know, we have just been dealt some incredible cards. We have control of things in a way that we haven't in a long time and we may not in the future. Let's grab it. Let's go for it and really do something with that control.
But isn't this a two-edged sword, John? I mean, if the governor, if Scott Walker succeeds, excuse me, in altering the nature of the governor's office in the state of Wisconsin to where he's basically a petty dictator, what happens when a Democrat takes that office? Or are they all just relying on the fact that traditionally, Barack Obama is probably a good example of this. He hasn't given up the powers that George W. Bush claimed, but he's not using them in the disgusting way that George Bush used them. But they're still intact.
Tom, you innocent, you gentle, sweet, uncynical man.
All right, wake me up here, John.
Can I just offer you a notion here?
Yeah.
If you combine your consolidation of power with the total disempowering of public employee unions, which in especially these upper Midwest states are the primary force to counter corporate money.
Oh, then you never have to worry about a Democrat being governor.
And you change, as the Republican legislature did in Wisconsin last week, the access to the polls, radically altering voting procedures and practices in the state, including now an open dialogue about eliminating our long tradition of same-day registration.
Right.
You understand?
Oh, yeah. This is Paul Weyrich on steroids. Jacob,
yeah.
You got Paul Weyrich in the 360, don't you? You don't?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. In any case, yeah. Paul Weyrich said this to a group of Republican strategists, back during the Reagan era. He said, why do all these Republicans talk about, good government? We don't want people to vote. In fact, as the voting populace goes down, our power goes up.
And so I think when we look at it this way, Tom, we see an incredible dynamic that is in play, not just in Wisconsin, but in a number of these other states. And this popular resistance, these massive crowds that have turned out, as well as the resistance of some individual and sometimes caucuses of Democrats, are really the only thing that is preventing this from happening. But the key thing is something that is always the most powerful thing in great battles, both in politics and in wars, to be honest, and that is time. What the Democratic senators who left gave this process was time, so that you and I can be talking about this today in a rational way, but about very profound things. The space, the time to have those discussions is the single most powerful force that may yet trip up Scott Walker and some of these other governors. This is a very important moment we're in.
Right.
It's clear that Walker is very, very nervous right now. He's stumbling. He has Republicans in his legislative caucuses who are clear, unquestionably, and in some cases publicly, saying we're very uncomfortable with this. We don't like where this is heading. The polls have turned against him. And so we're kind of on a tightrope now. We don't know how this is going to turn out. But I will tell you that the amazing thing is that sometimes information still is powerful enough that if you can get it to the people in time, they can save their democracy.
In time. That's the key. And in some ways, they can save what's left of their democracy. I mean, let's keep
right.
in mind, the battle that's going on in Wisconsin has already been lost in what, 16, 18, 20 other states?
Oh, yeah. No, I believe me. But this is the thing, Tom. When you lose it in states like Wisconsin, which and Minnesota, and some of these states which traditionally have
Michigan.
Been sort of your most progressive, your most functional states, then it's very hard to imagine how you get it back in South Carolina.
Right.
Or
Mississippi
that's
or Alabama.
That's one of the great progressives in South Carolina. It's just to say, if you're true blue, traditionally progressive, reform-oriented, good government states of the North start to fall apart, we don't have a lot left.
Yeah. America becomes a fundamentally different place, is the bottom line. John Nichols, TheNation.com, Cap Times, and all things extraordinary. John, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom, as
Great.
Always.
Thank you. And coming up next, State Senator Chris Larson, one of the Wisconsin legislators on the lam. We'll be talking with him. Or actually, filibustering. Let's call it what it is.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Stick around. State Senator Chris Larson from Wisconsin coming up right after this.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Don't you know?
That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain. Gang.
Sam Cooke, Chain Gang.
they work so hard till the sun is going down. Working on the highways and byways and wearing a frown. You hear them moaning their lives away. Then you hear somebody say, that's the sound of the men working on the chain.
This is requested by John, the Longshoreman, over at Jacob's blog here at TomHartmann.com. We're doing all labor songs all week in a salute to what's going on in Wisconsin and, frankly, states all around the country. And speaking of Wisconsin, Chris Larson, state senator from Wisconsin, the 7th District of Wisconsin, one of the 14 state senators who are using the constitutional right to filibuster the state Senate by denying it a quorum and going out of state. State Senator Larson, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what is the latest from your point of view and those of your colleagues? Where are we at? Where are you at right now?
Well, right now, obviously, Walker is under a lot of pressure. Senate Republicans are under a lot of pressure. What happened yesterday is you saw the release of these emails, some of the starting discussions that tried to initiate negotiations. Now, Walker's always said no negotiations, and I think that he's got a lot of public blowback for that. So he felt pressure to release these to make it seem like he's at least started to try and talk to us. But there's never been a commitment on his part for these things. Never, you know, the offer to try and usher these through the Assembly and the Senate or actually commit to these things. It was just the start of a discussion. So I think he's put these out there, and then the silence has been deafening on his side of whether he'd actually go with these things. I think he hopes that the public forgets and that we forget that he actually admitted in a billion-dollar phone call that anything that he had with that be a discussion with us would be a ruse in order to try and pass his bill anyway.
To what extent, you know, I was just talking with John Nichols, and he's concerned about what's in this bill for people on Medicaid, Badger Care, in the state. I'm concerned about the selling off of state utilities. It seems to me that you know, breaking the unions and breaking the back of the last organized, typically supportive of Democratic Party politics, but really supportive of democracy, small d democracy, breaking the back of the unions through destroying collective bargaining is really only a piece, and maybe even a small piece, of a larger agenda, which is basically dismantling the government of the state of Wisconsin and selling it off to the highest bidder so that it can be run by large corporations. Why is that stuff, things like, you know, selling off the utilities to the highest bidder, changing the rules for 400,000 people getting Badger Care and other state medical services, why is that not making the media? And is that a top-of-the-line issue for you guys, too, or are you just zeroed in on collective bargaining?
Well, we have to remember, look, we are in the minority. We are out here trying to make a point, and I think the biggest one, what's got the most people energized, is the attack on workers' rights, what's created the unions, what's created the middle class in Wisconsin, and really, in large part, the country, was unions. So we're trying our best to preserve that. There is some really bad stuff in this bill. You know, it's a Trojan horse of things that he tried to sneak through in 72 hours with corporate funding for TV commercials, trying to push for this passage before anyone had read it.
Right.
And a lot of these things have been discussed, and they've gone in the local media here, so people know what's in it. So these Senate Republicans are really under pressure to defend some of these strange provisions. Now, what the Democrats did yesterday is we proposed the fresh start. We proposed, okay, let's take the budget repair bill as it was and take out, empty out the Trojan horse, take all this bad stuff and throw it aside. The no bid contracts, the attacks on Medicaid and senior care, and obviously the attacks on workers' rights. We introduced those to give us a fresh start and say, okay, we can just deal with the fiscal side. And you know what? It actually saves more money than Walker originally proposed because it preserves grants and it also refinances debt. So this is kind of the discussion point to see if Republicans want to go with that or if they want to follow the ideological path of Walker in this right-wing race to the bottom, going with corporations over working class people.
If they decide to follow Walker, it seems that, at least from where I'm sitting here and, you know, 1,000 miles away, it seems that the best strategy would be for you guys to stay out of town until there's been a recall election and at least three Republican senators have been pulled out in May or June, I guess that would be, and then come back without the concern that you are essentially powerless unless you leave the state. Is A, do you think that that's an accurate assessment of the situation? And B, do you think that it's possible that you and your colleagues could pull that off?
Well, I mean, it would be highly idealistic to try and get all 14 of us to stay out for months. I think we won't need to stay out that long. I think it's going to be on those Senate Republicans who realize that their legislative career is at stake. You know, look, there's five or six who never liked this bill. They were willing to go along with it because Walker was their governor and they would rubber stamp whatever the guy wanted.
Right.
There was no consequence to the media. But now that these recalls have kicked up and now that everyone in the public knows what's in the bill and now that they tried to shut out the public and pushed them to the street where they really kicked up these recalls, they would have to end their legislative careers if they go along with it. And I think they recognize that and are kind of looking for a way out, which is why we've seen a six-hour meeting with the Senate Republicans yesterday, and they continue to meet today as their leadership continues to browbeat them and to try and push for this legislation, this attack on workers' rights,
yeah,
and this Trojan horse bill. I think they get it, and we're going to see a break there soon.
It's almost like that amazing scene in Downfall, you know, the movie about the last days of Hitler, where he orders half the guys out of the room and he starts screaming at the guys who are left, and they're all like, you know, this guy's going to kill himself soon anyway. You know, what are we doing?
I don't want to go any comparisons to that.
I know you don't.
Look, they are feeling the pressure.
I wasn't trying to take you in that direction. My apologies. I should save my commentary for when it's just me on the air, not you two.
There you go.
State Senator Chris Larson, a good man doing good work, and standing up for the people of the state of Wisconsin. I appreciate your being on. And legis.wisconsin.gov, of course, the website for the legislature. Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, is it okay for a former porn star to now be a grade school teacher? There's a bigger story here, actually.
Farewell, my companions, my friends, and my workmates. Farewell to the paydays of pints and the crack. Oh, we gave them our best years, though they paid us back. By making us yesterday's men, sure as hell. By making us yesterday's men.
Yesterday's Man by Celtic Thunder, requested by Granny M.
The workbench is bare, and a dust on the factory floor.
Okay, here's an interesting story. This just caught my attention. It combines the American story of redemption. It's really not even an American story. I think it's a universal human story. I think every human society has stories of redemption built into it. It's certainly at the core of our religions. And frankly, I think it's at the core of all of our cultures. Of people having the ability, of our honoring people who have made mistakes, getting up, dusting themselves off, moving forward, fixing their lives, and making things better. And then sometimes those mistakes come back and bite them. And do we as a society say, you made the mistake, you paid for the mistake, you've redeemed yourself from the mistake, it's behind you? Or do we as a society say, you made a mistake, we're going to keep beating you over the head with it? Here's what happened. A woman by the name of Tara Myers, teaching school in Parkway North, in St. Louis County, I'm assuming this is Missouri. I thought it was Massachusetts, but it must be Missouri. And she has been teaching there since 2007. So 8, 9, 10, 11. She's been teaching for 4 years. She went to the trouble of getting her teaching certificate, went to college, all this kind of stuff. But before that, in her own words, she said, I'm a girl from the wrong side of the tracks who's made a lot of bad decisions in life, this being the worst, the most major. I wish that I could undo it more than anything in the world. Now, what is it that she's talking about? When she was a teenager and a single mom and homeless, she made a porn film. And the students in this school, I mean, you know, everything's on the internet now, have found the porn film with her in it and brought it to the attention of the schools, or somebody did. In fact, one of the kids, actually, the kids are coming, trying to come to her defense. She's been suspended. One of the kids, Grisel Escobar, a girl, a Parkway North senior, who says she played volleyball with Myers as a coach for the school, said, "I can tell she cares about teaching her students, and she really cares about us. So I don't think anything she did should impact what she does now." Daryl Rockfield, who's a junior at Parkway North, said, "We really feel sorry for her son because he goes to our school and he's in our same grade." This is a woman who's changed her life. But about a decade ago, she was in a porn film, and now this school is debating whether or not she should be fired. She is asked to be put on indefinite suspension. They're debating it. They haven't fired her yet. My take on this is that what she did was not criminal. Now, I would never suggest to anybody who wants to be a teacher that when they grow up that they make porn films as a way of getting through teacher school or anything else. I mean, this wasn't how she got through teacher school. She was literally homeless with children. At the time, apparently, she thought this was her only option. I mean, I'm not inside her head. I can't tell you exactly what she thought. But this is the story she tells. But it's not like she had committed a crime. It's not like she had committed a crime against children. It's not like she had committed a horrible crime against society. She did something that was legal. Should this woman be punished for the rest of her life? Should she be denied the profession that she apparently has a clear calling for and loves teaching because of that? Curious your take on that. All our lines at 866-987-THOM are already tied up with people on other topics, which we will get to. If you want to call about this topic, feel free, 866-745-CONS. Those lines are open, 866-745-CONS. Anyhow, a lot going on in the world. Let's get into it. Jackie, Port Townsend, Washington. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
Hi. Well, this is my husband's idea. But you know how the NPR executive of fundraising said that, well, maybe it would be better if NPR didn't get federal funding because then it could have an independent and clear voice. Well, it's already established. It has good programming. There was an article in the Huffington Post on the 5th saying that they're hiring more journalists and going into investigative news. Mm-hmm. Maybe progressive financial backers should take it over and run with it.
Maybe. I'm very ambivalent about NPR, Jackie, because it's neither fish nor fowl. Ever since they started taking corporate money, they stopped doing investigative reporting and they stopped talking about what I think are many of the serious issues in America about corporate dominance. It's not part of their agenda anymore, and I think that's a shame. And it was when they were entirely government funded. On the other hand, if they're going to be entirely privately funded, then they're going to have to dance to that tune. You know, when they were entirely government funded, there was a 2-year break between the administration and the appointment of the head of the NPR, or of Public Broadcasting, CPB. So there was very little possibility of political interference, which was a good thing. And that's how it is with BBC. It's how it is with the French version. I forget what it's called. Deutsche Welle in Germany. It's how they do it. You know, they put a firewall in there. So very often the public broadcasting system is saying things that the government wishes they didn't say, but they don't have any control over it. It's the truth. I think that NPR, and thank you, Jackie, for calling. We're going to talk about this next hour, actually, with Dan Gaynor. I think, and gotcha journalism. I think NPR should decide whether they're going to be, you know, fish or fowl, whether they're going to be a government-supported entity. Actually, I think our legislators need to decide. Or whether they're going to, you know, go into the marketplace like Pacifica has done in the nonprofit realm, or as, Clear Channel has done, or, other, you know, other shows, networks in the for-profit realm, and either solicit advertising or solicit listener support and be their own agency. And I wouldn't presume to tell them how to run their business. I just think that as neither, they have a problem. JJ in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, JJ, what's up?
The teacher's dilemma. I have the perfect solution. She just needs to declare that she's a Republican, and then all is forgiven. I mean, from all the various Republican fiascos that we've seen, that they can do anything they want.
You're right. She could still be the governor of South Carolina. She could still be the senator from Nevada. Yeah. She could, you know, after David Vitter got busted with a prostitute, the senator from Mississippi or Alabama, whatever it is, Mississippi, I guess it is. He came back to a standing ovation from his colleagues. You're right. She should declare herself a Republican. You got it. Edward, thank you very much for the call. That's pretty amazing. That's a good one. Let's see. This is in the 303 area code. I don't have a name or city. What's up? You're on the air.
Oh, hey. No, I was just thinking that the students with this porn teacher, you know, or this porn star, every kid out there was actually probably searching her name on the internet, so it's going to be pretty distracting.
Count on it.
Hello?
Yeah, I said count on it. You know, if I was a 14-year-old boy and I knew that my teacher had been in a porn film, the first thing I'd be doing was looking for the film. Sure, of course.
Yeah, so I think it's a little distracting for the students to have that in the background, although I have nothing wrong. I don't think it's wrong what she did. You know, she was just making a living, and that's perfectly fine with me, but Anyhow, great show, man.
Do you think that she should be barred from being a teacher? I mean, if you're concerned about what's in the mind of kids, I can tell you, you know, when a 14-year-old boy sees a pregnant teacher, they're going, "Oh, I know what you've been doing."
Yeah, they think that, but then again, I mean, if you can download a JPEG of the teacher and pass it around class, I'm sure that can happen too. I mean, these you know, it's not like it was 20 years ago. These kids, this all this stuff is instantly available.
Yes, but so what?
I know, so what? But I don't know. I don't have an issue with what she did. I just think it's pretty distracting for children in class.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be thinking about that, you know, about what she's teaching. I'd be thinking about her.
Well, it depends on the quality of the teacher she is, I think. You know, it's and I don't know. Maybe you'd be thinking about her all the time. I think a lot of kids would probably think about her occasionally, or, you know, what her past was. But then, hey, she's saying, you know, we got a math test. You got to pay attention to the math test. I don't know. We'll see. Tony in Portland. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
You know, I absolutely agree with you. There's no way in the world she should be fired. You know, when you look at the prevalence of this and how easy it would be for girls to just slip into this. And,
yeah.
You know, you can't have a future then because you made a dumb mistake.
Yeah.
I mean, I have friends who don't know that their daughter made a porn tape, right, direct-to-web kind of a deal.
Right.
They would be devastated, right?
Yeah. Oh, there's probably, I mean, she made a commercial porn film. There's probably a whole bunch of, 16, 17, 18-year-old, 19-year-old, 20-year-olds, well, let's say 18 and above so we don't get into issues of child porn. You know, there's probably a bunch of young people who are making films with their boyfriends right now that are going to end up on the internet that are going to come back to haunt them. I mean, is this the new world we want? Tony, thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back. Your thoughts on whether teachers should be allowed, porn stars should be teachers, I guess. How would you say it? And what's going on in Wisconsin? A Routine Day by Klaatu, requested by Bruce. Okay, here's what you do. Here's how not to be an effective car thief. If you steal a car and you know, it breaks down or whatever, and you're trying to get a ride, and you go out and flag down a car to get a ride, try not to do what this guy in Salem, Oregon did. Try not to flag down an unmarked police car. It didn't work all that well. Yeah, Associated Press. When the suspect knocked on the window of the unmarked car and asked for a ride, he got one. Yeah. Okay. So a little more on this woman who in St. Louis County, Tara Meyer is her name. Terica Dye was the name she did her porn film under. She did one day in 1985. That's 16 years ago. She filmed for 8 hours. That's it. And you look at her now, and she looks like, you know, a average-looking mom in her 30s, maybe early 40s. I don't know how old she is, but, you know, back then, she's attractive. Back then, she was, too. But 8 hours, 16 years ago, and now she's a high school science teacher, and apparently a very good one. Her students are rallying behind her, and the school district is trying to figure out what to do. Barry in Asheville, North Carolina. Hey, Barry, what's up? Barry, you're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry. There we go. Hey, Barry.
Hello?
Hey.
Yeah, I'm noticing that the St. Louis TV stations are reporting that she had been forced to quit another teaching assignment some years before in Kentucky.
In Paducah, Kentucky, in 2006. That's right.
And I just wonder what sort of message they're sending to these children, and just not just at this school, but nationwide, about redemption. Here's a woman who made one mistake and has worked the rest of her life to pull herself up to do better, and she's still being kicked to the curb. I mean,
right.
They have a chance to teach a real lesson about redemption here, and they're doing the exact wrong thing.
Well, and even redemption might be too strong a word, because what she did was legal.
Exactly.
I mean, it's not like, you know, she was busted for selling crack to kids on a high school, you know, campus. It's, you know, what she did was legal. So does she even need to be redeemed from that? Although arguably, you know, there is a part of our society that has moral issues with pornography. I understand all that, but I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. And I think that if we believe in redemption and think that there's anything sketchy about what she did, that she has more than redeemed herself, and we should all put this behind us, and let her put it behind her, and let her get on with her teaching career. Apparently there are some folks who just don't believe that way. So maybe one of them will call. Laura in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Laura, your thoughts.
Hi. Yeah, I'm not one of those who thinks that she did do anything wrong. She committed no crime. This is 16 years ago. It's ridiculous that this is even a topic for the school district, considering that the school district is staffed by adults, and most likely at, you know, any given point in any of their lives, they themselves have watched pornography, which means they have been a part of it themselves, even if they weren't actually actors.
Yeah.
So for anybody, literally anybody who has ever seen and enjoyed watching any kind of pornography in their lives, to point a finger at this woman is completely hypocritical.
This is really truly one of those, Jesus came across the prostitute, and all these guys were going, oh, stoner, stoner. And Jesus said, you know, let he who is without sin among you cast the first stone. And they all quietly shut up and walked off.
I'm so glad you mentioned that phrase, because that is the very, very first thing that came to my mind.
Yeah. Yeah,
that is absolutely true. It's ridiculous. I don't understand how. I mean, we're talking 16 years ago. They need to look back in their own lives over the last 16 years. What are some things that they've done?
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's what I had to say.
Very well said, Laura. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to Tacoma on 1090. Wes in Orlando, Florida. Hey, Wes, what's up?
Oh, well, my weight and expectations. Talk about an unintended segue. Car thief. This lady did a porn movie, which was legal. And now they're ostracizing her. And, gee, don't we have a car thief in Congress who happens to be a chairman? He's a known car thief. Mr. Issa?
Oh, yeah, Daryl Issa. Yeah, he's actually pled guilty to a crime.
A serial car thief. Time. Yeah, he's a chairman of, is it Ways and Means, or what is he a chairman? I forget.
Governmental Oversight Committee.
Governmental Oversight Committee. That's what he's a chairman of a committee, and he's being upheld as a paragon of virtue. Here, this lady makes a mistake to support herself and her child because she was homeless, and they're ostracizing her. She should keep her job. If they fire her, she should sue them.
Yeah.
Plain and simple. And that way she can live off the radio. She can live. You know, everyone makes mistakes, Tom. I made mistakes when I was a kid.
Yeah. I have a long list too, Wes. I'm detecting a consensus here. Edward, last call on the of the hour. What's up? Edward in Capistrano Beach. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I don't think she did anything wrong, and I don't think that there's anything that anybody could say about pornography other than the fact that America's idea of sexuality is so repressed, and we make it so taboo that it pushes children into wanting to view it and see it. It's like drugs. It's like when you have a drug war, it basically anything taboo in the American psyche, Americans want to do. They don't like being told no or what they
can't. You're so right. Did you see Bill Maher's little riff on pornography about 2-3 weeks ago?
No, I didn't.
He did this riff where he talked about how people get into pornography and they need, you know, harder and harder doses and more extreme stuff, and pretty soon you're looking at, you know, schoolgirls being, you know, whatever, you know, on buses in Tokyo or something. He made up some wild thing. And there's something to be said about that. There is some dysfunction at the core of American society that I think goes back to Queen Victoria and is relatively unique to the United States and the United Kingdom, and that you don't so much find in continental Europe.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on in the world today. In the last hour on our radio program, we heard from John Nichols and State Senator Chris Larson in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin governor trying to privatize the state's utilities, break the state's unions, and cut health care services, state health care services, to 400,000 people. And apparently that's just the beginning. In Michigan, they want to be able to simply declare cities no longer cities and bring in Blackwater and let Blackwater run them. Blackwater, of course, Eric Prince's company, Eric Prince, from a famous Michigander who is now hiding out in the Middle East, I believe. So, you know, there's that going on. There's this fascinating story of this teacher in near St. Louis, Missouri, who 16 years ago spent 8 hours working in a studio making a porn film, and is now a high school science teacher and apparently a very, very good one and much beloved by her students. And this porn film has come out. Whatever happened to redemption in America? Second chances. We'll get into that. And the James O'Keefe crowd is at it again. This time they're punking NPR. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, it wasn't the James O'Keefe crowd. It was the liberals. They punked Scott Walker, you know, with the whole, hi, I'm David Koch. Oh, Mr. Koch. Well, in this case, with NPR, one of the NPR guys, the executive Robert Shuller, said some things that you wouldn't want to be said, at least on Fox News, in public. And now they are. And so he's left his job. What a surprise. So there's a whole variety of issues here, from the nature of journalism to the nature of American democracy, or America, really, American culture, to the nature of journalism, that I wanted to have a conversation with Dan Gaynor about. Dan is with the Business Media Institute, the Vice President and T. Boone Pickens Free Market Fellow. Businessandmedia.org is the website. And of course, Business and Media is a division of Brent Bozell's media watchdog empire, I guess you could say. Dan, do you have a degree in journalism?
I do have a degree. I just have more than 20 years experience in it.
Okay.
It's basically the trade industry. So, you know, pretty much a lot of people don't necessarily have degrees. Political science and history tend to be good degrees. Also have a publishing master's degree. So.
Okay. Yeah. I had it in my head that you did. I wasn't any kind of gotcha question.
Although we are in the era of gotcha, I didn't think that was one of them.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm curious your thoughts on this.
I mean, that's what this all goes back to. This is not journalism. It wasn't journalism when the guy pretended to be one of the Kochs. It wasn't journalism when they did this. But it doesn't matter, and no one seems to care. It's it is the era of gotcha. I mean, look, you know, O'Keefe, for all that the left hates him and journalists, you know, decry him, he helped take down Acorn, and now he really legitimately harmed NPR to the point where not just the guy he had on videotape, but the head of NPR was ousted today.
Yeah. On the other hand, O'Keefe was arrested for trying to bug Mary Landrieu's office. I mean, this is kind of a sketchy guy.
I'm not disputing that. If you're trying to bug a congressman's office, you should be arrested. You know, I don't care whether you're left or right. But, that's the problem. We've got to this point where the next generation, and this is going to sound one of those like geezer comments, you know, where the next generation doesn't seem to care about any sort of the values of journalism. They just want to catch people in gotcha moments. And then they want to find some sort of website that will broadcast. And it was newsworthy. So, of course, that's why it got broadcast.
So, are you feeling that, I mean, being in the public eye, and you are too, I think I'm probably a little more than you are, but I don't know how much, out there you are, in other media that I'm unaware of, but I know that, I mean, I can see, I'll get emails from people that are clearly bait. You know, they're just waiting for me to answer so that they can post it on a message board. And I not only do I ignore them, but I put them on the blacklist so I never see anything from that person again. But it happens with surprising frequency and regularity. And, Louise and I pretty much, we work 16-hour days and we're not so social. So there aren't so many opportunities for somebody to sit down at a restaurant with us and punk us. But, I got to tell you, I'm wary. Are you?
Oh, absolutely. I think anyone on the left and right, whether it's, I heard you mentioning, Think Progress, Lee Fong, whether it's him or someone in our organization or someone, any member of Congress, anybody who works for them, anybody in a prominent business or a prominent union, and frankly, celebrities, we basically become the paparazzi as a society. Everybody has.
Yeah.
If you're in a restaurant and you see somebody famous and they're being rude to a waiter or waitress, the next thing you know, that video is on there. We've all seen meltdowns of different celebrities, or we saw, Britney Spears walking out of barefoot out of a, gas station men's room. That's right. What all this is.
Yeah.
But it's still effective.
Yeah, it's the Charlie Sheen syndrome. Dan, in 1928, in the height of the Roaring Twenties, a curmudgeon by the name of Oswald Spengler wrote a book called The Decline of the West, which I read about a decade ago. And I don't expect you to be familiar with. Most people have never heard of Spengler or read his writings, although he was fairly well known in the late 20s. But in his book, in The Decline of the West, Spengler was looking at the Roaring Twenties. And he said, this is a society about to collapse. My words, not his, but damn close. He said, when society becomes a caricature of itself, then you know that collapse is coming. When it becomes, when the institutions of society become caricatures of themselves, when they become cartoon characters rather than the real thing, When the average person can't distinguish between the cartoon character and the real thing, then you know that that's a society in collapse. And sure enough, that society of 1928 did collapse, and arguably is resurrecting now in the in the roaring whatever it is. I realize the economic times are bad, but it seems to me that these are symptoms of some sort of social disease. Are we a couple of curmudgeons here sitting around commiserating, or are you going to argue with me on this?
Some of it's true. I mean, some of what you're saying, I think you and I can agree on. We all spent literally decades worried about Big Brother. And I think both left and right are still arguably worried about things like TSA and, examples of Big Brother. But it's Little Brother that's the problem. Little Brother that can, quite literally where every movement you make, I mean, people who use Foursquare are beyond me because I don't want the whole world to know every second where I'm going to be somewhere.
Yeah.
You're not safe in a restaurant. You're not safe just for people to get.
Well, here's the flip side of that, though, Dan, and pardon my interrupting you, but we only have a minute left. The flip side of that is if a citizen journalist, in quotes, catches somebody legitimately doing something wrong, you know, catches some congressman taking a bribe on the side or something. Don't you want that on YouTube?
Right. But see, then where do you draw the line? And I think that's where we found, like we saw with Christine O'Donnell, the, you know, the guy who said he slept with Christine O'Donnell but actually hadn't had sex with her. And still that ended up on, you know, national news. We see.
Somehow I missed that.
Get embarrassing photos of people. You know, like, okay, somebody sees a person leaving their house to get their morning paper in our bathroom.
Right.
I mean, it's, we lost the sense of privacy. And I mean, I think, you know, the technology and what people are doing with it can be wonderful, as we're seeing it in the Mideast, how wonderful it is.
Yeah.
But, you know, the genie's out of the bottle, and we really don't know where all this ends.
Yeah, this really is a new world of journalism. I find it fascinating.
And simultaneously. Yeah.
Pardon? Yeah, and I think that there's some real positive upsides to it and some real scary downsides to it. And I haven't sorted it out in my head yet, Dan, and I suspect you're going through the same thing.
I think everybody is dealing with the same problem.
There you
right
go.
Now.
Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org is the website. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, will Governor Brewer be recalled? And should a woman who starred a porn film 16 years ago be teaching? Well, Jan Brewer in Arizona promoting her version of Brewer Care. No, no, if you need a transplant, you can't get it. Sorry, you get to die. Two people already have. Among other things, remaking the state. A woman in Chandler, Arizona, who says she's a Republican, decided to launch a grassroots effort back in January to recall Governor Brewer. It seems to be taking on a life of its own. Dr. Matt Jett is with us, the spokesperson for the Committee to Recall Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. The website, recallgovernorbrewer.com. Dr. Matt Jett, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell me, first of all, who are you and what brought you to this?
I've been asked that question many a times, who I am. I think the Slim Jim version is I ran against Jan Brewer in last year's gubernatorial race. I was a Republican myself. I am now a registered Democrat. And I got into the gubernatorial race because Jan Brewer nearly 2 years ago said she was going to cut access, nearly 300,000 people. She was actually going to cut transplants. She was going to cut education and really hurt the economy in many different ways. That's why I got into the gubernatorial race then. Now, obviously, Jan Brewer won, and we know, I think, in large measure around the country why that happened to be, because the election itself was hijacked, to say it in not so many words, by one particular issue. And we've seen this issue come up even more so today with SB, I think, 1495, with the own state army regarding immigration.
Right.
So that issue has truncated all other types of conversation and, I think, more important issues, what's happening in Arizona. And then once the election, you know, was concluded, I got involved with the committee to recall Arizona Governor Jan Brewer with the founder out of Chandler, Mimi, and we've been working side by side, and we are very excited about what's happening here. And you are right. It is taking on a life of its own. Our volunteers have more than doubled in the past few days, and wow, and the donations have more than tripled. So we're very excited.
For our listeners on KPMX or HX in Phoenix, and well, we're also in Tempe. Well, we're statewide, actually, on Sirius and on XM and on Dish Network and DirecTV. For our listeners in Arizona, recallgovernorbrewer.com is the website. Of course, anybody in the country can go check it out and support in whatever way they can. But for people in Arizona, if you want to sign this petition and get this thing on the election, this is how to do it. We're talking with Dr. Matt Jett. You said you were a Republican and you became a Democrat because of the extremism of Brewer. My words, not yours. My father was a Republican. I grew up with a Republican. And he was an Eisenhower Republican. I don't think that he would have recognized Jan Brewer as a Republican. Is that kind of what happened to you, or am I misreading this?
I think what you're witnessing here, and if I can speak to this real briefly on it, is that you're seeing a trend towards the right regarding one particular party. And that's actually dragging the whole electorate that way. For example, If Teddy Roosevelt was alive today, he might very well be called a socialist for saving national parks and breaking up monopolies.
Right.
If Abraham Lincoln was alive today, he very might be called a liberal for what he did, you know, particularly against state rights. You know, yeah. In Arizona, it's quite interesting. If there's ever a more important time to teach our children about history, today is it. The same issues are coming up today we've been battling with since the founding of our country. So both Teddy and Lincoln probably wouldn't be Republicans. And if you go to the modern presidency, you would say, would Reagan even pass the smell test of being a Republican today? And a lot of people like to say Reagan is the spokesman of the Republican Party, but I highly doubt, and I think people like Karl Rove would even agree, that he probably would not be the same type of Republican needed to be in that party today.
Well, he was in favor of a woman's right to choose an abortion. He raised taxes 11 times in 7 years out of his 8 years of his presidency.
signed an amnesty bill.
He signed an amnesty for three and a half million illegal aliens.
Exactly. So I think what you're witnessing here is an extreme version taking hold of one particular party. And before, when I started, I was a moderate. And I've been called every name under the sun, particularly during the last election, for standing up what I think are not Republican or Democrat ideas, but actually human rights ideas and what is just and which is for equality for all individuals. That is what this recall for Jan Brewer actually is and represents, particularly in Arizona. And let me make one point clear. It's not just about a recall of Jan Brewer in Arizona. This is a statement, and we all know what the domino theory is back in the 1960s and early 70s. Sure. We are witnessing a domestic domino theory that if we do not stop it here in Arizona, we're witnessing it in Ohio and Wisconsin, everywhere around the country.
Yeah.
We are witnessing a domino effect.
So, in other words, what you guys are doing with regard to things like bigotry and cutting people off health care is what the guys up in Wisconsin are doing with regard to collective bargaining.
I think...
Drawing a line in the sand.
Absolutely. The line has... There's only two teams here. Either you're with them or you're with us. And what Republicans are great at, and I think you agree with this, is that you can define a Republican in one sentence or two. All right? And probably in a matter of 30 seconds. Ryan, you can probably put out a symbol and you'd probably... To describe what a Democrat is, it takes a long time. And there's so many different issues that Democrats feel strongly about that we need to unite under a common flag, under common principles that says we will not take it anymore, we will take a stand. And that's what this recall in Arizona of Jan Brewer is.
Yeah.
We are drawing a line in the sand of Arizona. For the past 2 years, we have been taking enough of it, and we are drawing a line before it's too late, before it affects other states, and before it affects our children of tomorrow.
Yeah, very, very well said. We're talking with Dr. Matt Jett, spokesperson, the Committee to Recall Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. The website, recallgovernorbrewer.com. What's the deadline, and how many signatures do you need?
We need a minimum roughly 432,000 signatures by May 28th. I'm sorry?
And how are you doing?
We're doing fantastic. Like I said before, our volunteers have doubled and our contributions have more than tripled.
That's great. Okay, get over to Recall Governor, spelled G-O-V-E-R-N-O-R, Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R, .com, and check it out. Do I have it right, Matt?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. Good luck and keep up the great work. Thanks for being on our show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, as Republicans are being recalled in Wisconsin, are the Republicans trying to change the recall laws in Wisconsin? You're not going to believe this.
Well, some people think that unions are too strong. Union leaders should go back where they belong. But I wish that they could see a little more poverty, and they might start to sing a different song. Well, let's look at
Phil Oaks, Hazard, Kentucky, requested by Anonymous. Our last song, by the way, The Trees by Rush, had been requested by Spicoli. My apologies for missing that. And here, let's hear a little more Phil Oaks.
There's a hazard in Hazard, Kentucky. And if you ain't mining there, well, my friend, you're awful lucky. Because if you don't get silicosis or pay, that's just atrocious. You'll be screaming for a union that will care.
There you go. Phil Oaks, Hazard, Kentucky. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number. Looks like the Republicans are getting a little nervous. The Republican leader in Wisconsin, Mr. Fitzgerald, Scott, of all names, Scott Fitzgerald. said, I mean, what I do believe is that we're taking those recalls seriously and we're making sure that we can do everything available to those senators to make their case. His off-the-cuff comments sounded less like he was mulling any significant actual prescriptive efforts to change the law. But later he says, yeah, I've always been a believer that recall probably would be more appropriate if a legislator was involved in some type of, you know, criminal activity or something that could be deemed, you know, unethical. This was when he was asked if he thought that the recall process should be changed. The first word in his answer was yes. So that doesn't mean that he's really up about that, you know, that that's what he's really up for. So a whole variety of things in the news today, from ranging from this poor teacher in St. Louis who, when she was a homeless mother of two, spent one day making a porn film, and it has come back to haunt her now as a middle-aged woman teaching high school science and apparently doing a very, very good job of it. Should she lose her job? There's three stories on the front page of the second section of the Financial Times today that I just have to tell you about to assist you with your fiscal and financial and international finance literacy, and also, well, you can make investment decisions based on your own based on this. But the first is the main headline in today's Section 2 of the Financial Times: demand grows for synthetic junk bonds. Now, you remember collateralized debt obligations, these CDOs, there were like 900 trillion of them floating. Those are called synthetic derivatives. Why are they synthetic? Because they don't actually represent anything. They're synthesized out of other things. It's like made-up stuff. Demand grows for synthetic junk bonds. They're looking for junk bonds. Hey, start a company, call it Acme Widget Company, say you're going to make slingshots for Wile E. Coyote, issue $100 million in bonds, you got banks that will buy them, they will turn them into CDOs, and they'll sell them for $150 billion in tranches all over the world. Okay, so that's going on. In other words, the bubble is reinflating because we have not put regulations into place. We did not learn our lesson. Number one, the bubble is reinflating. Right next to that, two stories that are really worthy of note. The first is B of A's chief bullish outlook. This is the Bank of America that was shut down yesterday by U.S. Uncut because in 2009 they used 119 offshore tax havens to avoid paying any income taxes in the United States. Here's a bank that pays no income taxes in the United States, and here's the first sentence from this article on the front page of the second section of today's Financial Times. First sentence: the chief executive of Bank of America has predicted pre-tax earnings of $35 to $40 billion a year once its business recovered from the financial crisis. $35 billion a year they're planning on making. They pay no taxes. And now, back to the junk bonds. Here's this story, on the one hand, says, demand grows for synthetic junk bonds. In fact, the subtitle is Hedge Fund Interest Reflects Optimism. And next to it is a picture of Carl Icahn. Those of you old enough to remember TWA and what Carl Icahn destroyed it. He's got this major hedge fund. He's one of these guys, you know, one of these Wall Street billionaires. And the caption underneath the photo says, Carl Icahn, the activist shareholder, has decided to return money to investors. He's got his own hedge fund. He's going to give the money back to the investors because he is unwilling to manage their money through another downturn. So, on the one hand, you've got an article about how all the guys on Wall Street are looking for crap that they can sell to jack up prices and make more profit. Another article about how the Bank of America is looking at making $35 billion in profits, not revenue. And a third article about how one of the smartest guys on Wall Street, Carl Icahn, is getting the heck out of Dodge by June. He's going to give all of the money back to his hedge fund customers and say, that's it, I'm out of here, here's your money back, good luck, you're on your own. Why? Because he sees a crash coming. I do too. But I'm not Carl Icahn. I'm not a billionaire, and I'm not a billionaire. When Carl Icahn speaks, I take it seriously. As much as I dislike the guy, Well, I don't know him personally, but as much as I dislike some of the many of the things he's done, particularly what he did to the TWA pilots and flight attendants, they were called stewardesses back in that time, and the airline itself. Anyhow, a lot on our table today. Let's pick up your phone calls, get your thoughts on all of these things. Susan in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Susan, thank you for watching, listening, whatever you're doing. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi, Thomas. I'm just so happy to be able to talk to you, and I can't even articulate to you how important your show is and what an impact it has. I want to thank you for educating, helping to educate people, because that is what you do. And to give you a classic example, and we are very actively involved in recalling Roberta Darling, signed petitions.
She's the Republican state senator in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And I can tell you people are extremely concerned about what's going on in this state. Yeah. And even though I'm not a union member, I have serious concerns about this bill and about the public utilities and just the whole package. With a lot of help from you, we can see exactly what this is all about. But to give you an example of this media blackout we've got here, I mean, and you just mentioned Fitzgerald. There was one short little clip that was on maybe MSNBC last night or the other night after they played one little clip of Michael Moore when he was there.
Right.
And Fitzgerald had to jump in last word and say, but nobody saw it because nobody heard it because there wasn't even anybody there that day.
Right, other than 50,000 people.
Other than 50,000 people.
But there was no media.
There was no media.
Yeah, had there been 50,000 Tea Partiers or Glenn Beck followers, I guarantee you, Susan, there would have been, the ABC truck would have been there, the NBC truck would have been there, the CBS truck would have been there, the AP truck would have been there. They all would have been there.
And you wouldn't believe our local television. I have a friend who is a teacher. He doesn't know what's going on. He calls me. I give him the news at the end of the day. I say, here's what's happening. They're there. They're in Madison. I said, what news are you watching? He turns on our local news and you get nothing.
Right.
They're not showing anything that's going on.
You're getting the latest car crash and
exactly.
the dog or the cat stuck in the tree or something.
Right.
Jump
on a story like you just talked about where they're going to pick on some teacher,
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Right, which is tragic in and of itself as well. Actually, I think that's a morality story for all of America. And there are also really important things going on. And I think it's useful to look at the whole spectrum, because I think that the teacher story actually is meta to the issue of the collapse of morality in the United States. And that's not to say that what she did is immoral. It's that the idea of there not being redemption in this country is immoral. That's just my take. Hey, Susan, I've got a lot of calls. I want to move along. Thank you so much for calling in. I truly appreciate it. Stephen in Helsinki, Finland. Hey, Stephen, thank you very much for listening, watching, whatever you're doing. What's up?
Thanks, Tom. I just wanted to chime in and add my little bit about what's happening with this teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I know everybody's, you included, have been talking about the alleged morality or immorality of this. But the truth is, the morality or immorality of it is irrelevant, and I'll explain why. This is really just a matter of law. Has she broken any laws?
Well, that was my original point. She did nothing illegal.
And I think it's a great one. And I think that's really the crucial issue. If she's broken no laws, then we have nothing to talk about. And the people at her school who are deciding whether to fire her have nothing to talk about.
Right, right. They've got, they have no stones to throw to mangle Jesus' parable. And David Vitter, who actually was busted with a prostitute, or John Ensign, who was paying off his mistress, they're still in the U.S. Senate. I mean, what does that say about morality in America?
Well, let me just add to that. We also have a former President Clinton, who not only lied to a grand jury, but admitted to smoking marijuana when it was, frankly, illegal.
Yeah, although he didn't inhale.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, you know, that Well, that's kind
yeah.
of, well, yeah.
I know, I know.
Like this, it's a bit silly.
Yeah. Steve and I take it you're an American working in Helsinki?
Correct.
Yeah.
But I think the bottom line here is we need to ask ourselves, this is really an issue about equal justice under law.
Yes.
This is a law issue, and if she does end up getting fired, she must contact her union. I hope unions aren't illegal where she is.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Stephen, I got to wrap it up. Thank you for the call. Well said, and thanks for listening to us in Finland.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
Coming up next, Talk Radio News with all the latest from Washington, D.C., plus your calls.
We are strong.
We are strong.
We are strong.
We are strong. We're a force unstoppable. In union, we are strong.
That's Unstoppable in Madison, written for Wisconsin and sent to us by Graham and Barbara.
They met him halfway, but he would not compromise.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and Ellen Ratner in the studio with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen. Welcome.
Well, thank
Great
you so
to see
much.
You.
Well, yes, there's quite a bit going on. There's actually a debate on the floor of the Senate as we speak with Rand Paul, just recently speaking, talking about the military budget going up 120% since the year 2001, saying we have to slash that. Of course, he also talked about slashing absolutely everything else,
right,
including entitlements. It was very interesting. I can't believe he said this on the floor of the Senate. He said that the president was tone deaf. That was really quite astounding. He also said that cuts don't cover a day of borrowing that both Republicans and Democrats are trying to do, so he actually went after both of them. And never a talk show host that doesn't miss an opportunity. Mike Pence, former talk show host and, of course, Republican from Indiana, was on Fox News this morning. He said it was time to pick a fight.
With whom?
With the Democrats.
Well, like it hasn't been going on.
Right, I understand.
It's time to start now.
That's what he's saying. He says sometimes you have to win these small battles.
Right.
Okay, some other interesting things going on. Gaddafi is sending a high-ranking military member to Egypt to talk to the Egyptian military. I guess this guy is in charge. His name, Major General Al-Zawi is his name, and he's in charge of logistics and supplies for Gaddafi's army, and he is trying to talk the Egyptians into helping him. Meanwhile, General Amos, remember him, Don't Ask, Don't Tell fame, from the Marines, he said that there are four major bases on Tripoli that have air assets, that their air assets there are modest, but they do exist,
Libyan air assets.
Libyan air assets, that they have 24-hour surveillance going on there, and of course, there was also another airlift to Egypt today, helping people to get to Egypt.
For the refugees who are fleeing across
the
eastern border.
And a lot of the Egyptians who are actually working in Libya.
Right. Very, very interesting. I'm curious, do you think that Gaddafi sending one of his right-hand men to Egypt, A, that the guy might defect once he gets to Egypt?
Well, that's what I was thinking.
Or B, that he's not going there to try to get any kind of help. He's going there to try and negotiate safe passage from Omar.
Well, all of those may be true. And again, this comes into the today. General Amos was under heavy questioning about air cover and about no-fly zone.
They do a no-fly zone. He's toast.
Oh, he's toast.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't believe in American intervention, but I got to tell you,
There are times.
There are times. Vice President Biden is actually in Moscow. He is recommending that they enter the World Trade Organization. Meanwhile, the Republicans are going after him, saying, we can't get a budget together, and why is he out of the country? And all of a sudden, Biden, who they consider, you know, was a pain in the neck last week, all of a sudden he's gone
out. They want him back.
They want him back to negotiate all of this.
I'm curious how the Russians are responding to his suggestion that they join the WTO.
Well, I think they want that. I mean, I think that's something that they've been trying to get in for a while, actually.
Interesting.
Okay, the White House today issued a very interesting statement on Abiy. I don't know if you remember Dominic from our trip 3 years ago, but he is actually the commissioner in the Abiy region.
You're talking about the trip to Sudan.
This trip to Sudan, and
well, that was a lot. I thought it feels like it was last year.
Yeah, well, it's actually 3 years ago this month.
Wow.
Time flies when you're having fun.
It does.
But it was in the Abyei region, and that there is this disputed area. 100 people were killed. The president of the United States, Obama, just sent out something that called on Bashir and President Kiir to meet in possible and to demonstrate that they're serious about making this urgent. This is the first time I've actually seen the president come out with a full statement. And again, if you I don't know
good
if you remember Dominic, I'm sure you met him, but he is now the commissioner for the area. So
He was the
representative of CSI.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yes, so
yeah.
You remember him.
Yeah, I do.
And now he's the commissioner in Abyei.
Amazing.
I know.
Amazing. So the president of the United States is asking, you said Bashir and Kiir, and I don't think most people know what you're talking about. Bashir is the president of North Sudan, and Kiir, Salva Kiir, is the president of South Sudan, the guy that we met with. When
that's
we were
right.
The president
we spent
of
a long time with him, a couple hours.
Yes. And, of course, the president of North Sudan, Mr. Bashir, is under indictment in the International Criminal Court for war crimes and for crimes against humanity for Darfur. And the president of South Sudan was the leading freedom fighter. Well, actually, he was the winner. I mean,
right.
You know, he beat the North in independence. And I would think that a meeting between the two of those guys would be pretty unlikely.
Well, but you know, it is that President Kiir is officially the vice president of all of Sudan.
Of Northern Sudan, yeah.
Until the 9th, when they become a separate country, 9th
right.
of July.
Right.
And supposedly they talk frequently. But
Well, what they talk about, I would think, is you know, how they're dividing up the oil revenue from China.
That's exactly what they talk about. Okay, a couple other quick things. The president says that he is going to veto spending cuts, any bill that the Republicans are putting, because he said that actually the White House said today, if the president's presented with a bill that undermines the priorities or national security through funding levels restrictions or contains earmarks or curtails the drivers of long-term economic growth, the president will veto it. Now, it is interesting, the Republicans are working very hard to get people on their side who are Democrats, people like Governor Manchin of West Virginia, who said essentially about the president that there was a leadership problem.
Right.
But,
yeah.
Of course, he's
going to
be... Yeah,
Joe Manchin is, as I said yesterday to Victoria, I think he's the next Joe Lieberman.
Yes, definitely, and he's trying to position himself that way.
Which seems stupid to me, because the Republicans will look at him and go, okay, so he's behaving like a Republican, but I'd rather have a real Republican. And the Democrats will look at him and go, this guy's a Democrat.
And we're not going to vote for him.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Well, that's what's going on, and they're obviously doing their very best to get Governor Manchin on their side.
Is he sitting in Robert Byrd's seat?
He is. And remember, it's a temporary, so now he's up for re-election again in 2012.
Oh.
And he's got a Republican at the door who is really after him. And the real right-wing sort of Family Research Council that has a different name in West Virginia is just very rich, and they are putting out stuff about him all the time.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Are we facing, in the person of New York Congressman Peter King, a new McCarthy Army hearings, only this time instead of communists, it's Muslims? Here's the debate.
Chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, Peter King, is set to officially launch his investigative hearings into American Muslim communities this Thursday, despite pleas to broaden his investigations into non-Muslim domestic threats like white power or anti-government militia groups. King is pushing ahead with his narrow scope aimed solely at Islamic threats. Over 80 religious leaders from all denominations wrote a letter to King last month asking him to think twice about these investigations. As the letter read, quote, "Building and maintaining trust with the Muslim community is crucial to furthering this cooperation, and we fear your hearings will only sow greater distrust and division at a time when unity and moral courage are needed." So is King dividing our nation and embarking on a 21st century McCarthy-esque witch hunt? Joining us to offer their takes, Alejandro Butel, government and policy analyst at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, and Seton Motley, the president of Less Government.
dot org.
Yes, exactly.
I'm surprised not dot com, actually. So, anyhow, Seton, conservatives like Tim McVeigh, Jim David Atkinson, Eric Rudolph.
Why are they conservatives?
Have killed a
Why
lot
are they conservatives?
Of, these are all people who claim that they were conservatives, have killed a lot of people, and conservatives like them continue to threaten America.
Three
to
25
day.
Years.
Why, I can actually give you a much longer list. Why won't Peter King investigate these right-wingers who are threatening America and have killed so many Americans?
For the same reason Willie Sutton robbed banks, it's where the money is. I have a list in my pocket right here of 24 domestic Muslim terrorist incidents thwarted or executed since 9/11. Half of them, 12 of them, involve multiple people, not just a single isolated person, but multiple people working in league with other terrorist organizations around the world. Now, I'm not saying
I can give you a long list of conservatives
but there are a lot of the times you start out accusing them of being conservative, and then people like Jared Loughner turn out not to be. So a lot of those lists are fraudulent.
Okay. All right, Alejandro. Conservative Muslims killed a lot of Americans on 9/11. But have also killed a lot of Muslims in other parts of the world. How does the Muslim community best deal with its murderous conservatives? You know, and do you think that Peter King's so-called investigation is going to increase the power and the number of these radical or conservative sure. Muslim?
First of all, thank you very much for having me on here, Tom. And second, I think that like all other Americans, Muslim Americans are very concerned about terrorism. You mentioned before that Muslim violent extremists such as Al-Qaeda and bin Laden have been largely killing a lot of other Muslims around the world in addition to the horrific acts on 9/11. And according to a study by West Point, 85% of all of Al-Qaeda's victims are actually Muslims. So that's the first point. The second point, though, is going here to our shores is that Muslim Americans, again, are very, very concerned about this issue, and we're frontline partners in the fight against terrorism. According to a study that we've been doing for several years now, our post 9/11 terrorism incident database, we have found that 2 out of every 5 Al-Qaeda plots have been thwarted since 9/11 because of the assistance of Muslim community members. So when Representative King is saying, for instance, that our community is not cooperating with law enforcement or that we're not doing enough to combat extremism, I'm sorry, but his quotes are wildly off the mark.
Seton, Peter King worked as a lawyer with Roy Cohn, who was the famous lawyer for Joe McCarthy. Do you think that he's modeling himself after Joe McCarthy?
McCarthy was right.
I have here in my pocket 24, the names of 24 communists working
he
in the State
right.
Department. McCarthy was right. So you think that Peter King is appropriate to do this?
Yes, absolutely. Look, and some parts of the Muslim community, do you know Mohammed El-Abiari by any chance? He's a good friend of mine. So I know what you're talking about. There are large swaths of the Muslim community that are working against terrorism. He didn't say the entire Muslim community isn't working against terrorism. He has run into pockets of American mosques and Muslim communities that are working
terrorism,
against terrorism.
Shouldn't he
that
be
are working
looking
against
into
exposing terrorism?
Shouldn't he be looking into terrorism as a whole rather than just Muslim
the vast
terrorism?
Majority of terrorist attacks in the United States and the world right now are conducted by people acting in the name of Islam.
Okay.
So if you want to ignore
Alejandro,
that, and you can do so
at
your peril, I don't want to do it.
So actually, when we look at, for instance, terrorist attacks directed at the United States, in fact, what we find is that since 9/11, there have been 45 by Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, but over 80 by non-Muslim violent extremists. We're talking about neo-Nazis, we're talking about anti-government extremists and other folks. The other important point to make here is that of those 80 cases, 5 of them actually involved chemical, biological, or radiological weapons, attempted or actual possession of such weapons, and none of them were by a Muslim American. Case in point would be in 2003, William Krar. He was not an Al-Qaeda affiliate. He was an anti-government extremist. His religion was not Islam, and frankly, it doesn't even matter what his religion was. But the point being is that while there's so much of a focus right now solely on Muslim violent extremism, I think what we need to do is have a comprehensive approach to this issue, because if we don't, then we're imperiling our national security.
He just made my point for me. He said there are 95 Muslim-related violent activities versus 80 by everybody else on the planet.
No, I said 40. I said 45.
Okay,
45 Muslim.
45. But that's
the majority is non-Muslim. Seaton. I have sitting at my desk a list of over 200 conservative attacks.
You like Jared Loughner, like the guy who shot up the World War II Memorial, conservative,
like
and then
the
ended
guy,
up not being
like the guy who walked into the Unitarian Church and murdered a couple of people. I mean, you could go
to
all
pretend
the way, all
that
the way
both
back.
Domestically and globally that there isn't a gigantic problem with people murdering people in the name of Islam is
or in
a
the name
death
of,
cult
in the,
diversity
in the name of anti-abortion,
that I don't want to engage
or in the name of, you know, blowing up the
Seaton. Everyone, you and I both will find common ground at the fact that we are very concerned about Muslim violent extremism. The question, the difference between, I think, you and I right now, though, is how do we go about it? And that's the question. Are we going to be treating the overwhelming majority of Muslim communities as partners in this fight? Because, frankly, we do have a dog in this fight. Or are we going to be treating them as suspects? And what I'm saying is that in order to go forward on this effectively, we need to make sure that we're treating our Muslim American communities as any other Americans and as partners in this fight.
And King did not arrive at this decision to have this hearing in 5 seconds. He's been investigating for a long time, and what he wants to do is expose the portions of the American Muslim community that aren't cooperating in the way that they should.
True. I wish that was true.
It's absolutely true.
But unfortunately, though, the way that this is going about is that this is focusing more on broad-brushed issues as opposed to actually targeting a violent fringe of individuals, which both you and I are very, very concerned about.
Alejandro, what, in your opinion, is the best way for America to deal with radical Islam, with conservative Islam?
I think that what we need to do is really look at the U.S. Constitution. I think that both you and I, Seaton, are constitutionalists together here. And ultimately, what I say is a constitution's counterterrorism strategy, in which at the end of the day, what we need to make sure is that the marketplace of ideas works itself out against any sort of extremist ideology, where Muslims are at the forefront of combating the ideas, and law enforcement makes sure that it is focused, very targeted, on those particular criminal elements, so this way we can make sure that there's no injustices and we don't play into the hands of the propagandists for the terrorists.
Alejandro, Seaton, thank you both for being here with us tonight.
And
we need to make sure that our efforts.
And let me add to this that the work being done to find Muslim extremists, frankly, in my opinion, instead of being done by a congressman in a public committee whose grandstanding in the tradition of, as Seaton just pointed out, in the tradition of Joe McCarthy, should be being done by the FBI quietly behind doors or within the FBI headquarters or other appropriate places where, you know, by law enforcement. You track down bad guys with law enforcement. You don't do it in the floor of the United States Senate or the House of Representatives unless you try to be a political opportunist.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls on Muslim extremism, the porn star teachers, and what's going on in Wisconsin. Trees Are Gone by Jello and Mojo, requested by Jared over at Jacob's blog on TomHartman.com. There you go. Okay, last night on Bill O'Reilly's program, the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan. Now, I used to live just down the road from Dearborn, Michigan. Louise and I lived in Westland, which is next to Inkster, which is next to Dearborn, if my geography recall is intact after all these years. Anyhow, it was just, we drove through Dearborn a lot. This is where Henry Ford started out. And the mayor of, and Dearborn is now, if not the, one of the largest, both as a percentage and in terms of absolute numbers, Muslim communities in the United States. And these are not, by and large, first-generation Muslims. They are second, third, fourth, fifth-generation Muslim immigrants, people who have been here as long as many Americans, people who have been here much longer than for example, my father and his family who came here in 1917, and they're Americans. They think of themselves as Americans. And their religion is Islam. And so O'Reilly is going, you know, I'm really worried about this, and, well, here's the clip.
You know, when someone goes into what is supposed to be fact-finding, but they've already determined the outcome, then that fact-finding process is flawed. You know, for us, we've lived for 80 years with Muslims as an active part of our community. We've had direct experience, and I think that that's something that's been misrepresented and misunderstood all throughout the country by certain groups. But if we base decisions, if we base policy on extreme decisions, we're going to make the same mistakes we've made over in the past, where we've infringed on people's constitutional rights because we've presupposed that they're disposed to doing something wrong. Our experience in our community says that's just not true.
And that was not Bill O'Reilly, if I misspoke. That was the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, Jack O'Reilly Jr., D for Democrat. And he basically says, you know, King's fear-mongering just isn't true. So... anyway, there's a lot going on here. Let's pick up your calls, your thoughts on all these issues. Jim in New York City. Hey, Jim, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Me too. Hey, Phil Oakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it great?
Yeah, always under Dylan's shadow, but, you know,
yeah.
He did okay.
He
legal
did.
Tragically. Legal issues aside, my take on the teacher issue is that it's just another typical right versus left real view. You know, and perhaps it's my own moral dilemma, but I would support the teacher, but at the same time, I don't believe Newt Gingrich, a second chance or redemption, if you like.
Well, here's the difference. The teacher is teaching science. She's not teaching a class about whether or not you should be a porn star. Newt Gingrich, who has been married three times and delivered his divorce papers to his first or second wife as she was coming out of cancer surgery, is preaching the sanctity of marriage. And so I'm with you. I mean, Newt used to be my congressman. When he divorced his wife, I was living in Marietta, Georgia. Newt was my congressman. And I can tell you, there were a lot of us who were going, hey, what? And, you know, when he was prosecuting Bill Clinton, he was getting it on in the back room with his girlfriend. And he, as were five of the Republicans who were prosecuting Bill Clinton. And
hypocrisy in cap.
Pardon?
Hypocrisy in capital letters.
Yes, yes. And that's hypocritical. I don't see what Tara Myers is doing, this teacher. I don't see it as hypocritical at all. I see it as a person trying to put their life back together. And
no, go ahead. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But
okay.
I mean, but for people, you know, like I said, legal issues aside, but for just people viewing it, you know, me personally, morally, you know, hey, she's young. Maybe like you said, maybe she had a feeder kid. But if, say, I did live in Newt's district or whatever, and I went into the voting booth, you know, morally, I'm saying, well, no, in this case, it's not okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not...
Well, like I said, Newt is preaching something different than she is. If she was out there as a pro-porn crusader or something, then I'd say, no, she's got no place being in the public schools. Instead, she's repudiating this. She's saying, I made a mistake. I put it behind me. Porn is legal. And so, you know, it almost... But, Jim, thank you for your call. And, by the way, a point that you made is one that I want to emphasize. And the person, I believe in giving credit where credit is due. The person who sensitized me to this, I'm going to sneeze, excuse me, was Marianne Williamson. Many years ago, she made this comment. Louise and I were having dinner with her after one of the democracy or the Global Renaissance Alliance meetings years ago in Detroit. No, it was after I was the guest preacher at her church in Detroit, the Church of Tomorrow, or the Church of Today or whatever it is. And in any case, Marianne said, the difference in morality, in her observation, the difference, and I'm paraphrasing, these are my words, not necessarily hers, but I think it's close. She said, the difference in morality between conservatives and liberals is this. Conservatives are worried about what people do in private. Liberals are worried about what people do in public. Conservatives want to know what you're doing in your bedroom and what you're smoking in your living room. Liberals want to know whether we have, in public, homeless among us, hungry among us, sick among us, who are not getting treatment, whether we are publicly imprisoning people for no good reason. And that, that has stuck with me. I mean, this had to be at least 15 years ago. This has stuck with me all these years. That as one of the most profound statements, not just on morality, but on the difference between conservative and liberal morality that I have ever heard in my life. From Marianne Williamson, I think of her as one of the great moral thinkers of our time. Anyhow, 27 minutes past the hour, we'll be back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, the good, the bad, and the mind-bogglingly ugly. And your calls. It's time now for the good, the bad, and the incredibly ugly, brought to you in part by EdisonFactor.com. Food for the mind. It contains complex supplements for the brain and important brain neurotransmitters. I drink it daily. The good, Mayor Jack O'Reilly Jr. He's the mayor of Dearborn, Michigan, home to the largest Muslim population in the country, so it seems like he should have a pretty good perspective on the threat of American Muslims. In an interview on CNN yesterday, O'Reilly said this about Republican Peter King's investigations into radicalized Muslims.
You know, when someone goes into what is supposed to be fact-finding, but they've already determined the outcome, then that fact-finding process is flawed. You know, for us, we've lived for 80 years with Muslims as an active part of our community. We've had direct experience, and I think that that's something that's been misrepresented and misunderstood all throughout the country by certain groups. But if we base decisions, if we base policy on extreme decisions, we're going to make the same mistakes we've made over in the past, where we've infringed on people's constitutional rights because we've presupposed that they're disposed to doing something wrong. Our experience in our community says that's just not true.
Well said. Let's see if Congressman Peter King calls up Mayor O'Reilly as a witness in his sham hearings. The bad. Republican Congressman Denny Rayburg of Montana. In a video released yesterday, Rayburg is repeatedly asked to identify the current minimum wage in Montana. He stays silent and finally tells the young man asking him the question, "I don't know, what is it?" If his being so out of touch wasn't bad enough, according to the Clark Fork Chronicle, Rayburg is the 14th wealthiest member of Congress, and he has repeatedly voted against Democratic-backed measures aimed at raising the minimum wage. Just for the record, the minimum wage in Montana was recently raised to $7.35 an hour, 10 cents higher than the national rate. And the very, very ugly Bill O'Reilly. While analyzing the potential Republican nominees for president in 2012 in a show last night, O'Reilly let loose this little nugget of racism, saying Barack Obama had a huge advantage because he was the first black ever to run. Huge advantage! First of all, the president is not a color. Just like you are not white, Bill. And second, one out of three African-American children living in poverty, it is sadly not an advantage to be an African-American in the United States. But from his pedestal, Bill has a hard time seeing that, and that's very, very ugly. Yep, you can express yourself. You can answer our poll question right now. Our poll question for the day, 25% of all the homeowners in the U.S. are underwater on their mortgages. Two-thirds of homeowners in Nevada are underwater. Will anything be done about it? Possible answers? Yes, banksters who inflated the housing bubble and lured folks into buying homes who couldn't afford it won't get away with it. Or no, and the banksters have enough money in their pockets to go and reinflate another bubble to screw us all over again. You can vote over at TomHartman.com. The poll will be open until this time tomorrow. Well, until a few hours before now tomorrow. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Sam in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, one of the Tom Hartman Program's most famous and highly revered folk philosophers. Sam, welcome.
Yes, sir, Professor Hartman. And you know, you and Louise, I think, need a vacation. You ought to come here to Point Pleasant. I'd like to send you a brochure.
Oh, we would love to, Sam. You should
do
that.
You're going to go to Charlottesville and visit Thomas Jefferson's Grand Ole Virginia home. You ought to come all the way over to the state, right here on the high border. And tag on my son. You know, he used to work in Columbus when all this mess started. And Joe the plumber, my son's a plumber. Anyways, that goofy governor over there. Anywho, anyhow, you know, I love you guys for what you're doing, and it's all a smokescreen. Republicans are putting up smokescreens left and right.
Because
the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were smokescreens for the billionaires to do their agenda. This thing with Gaddafi, I wouldn't be surprised if G.W. Bush is talking to him on the phone by Putin in Russia, and the old order is going to be the new order.
Yeah. So you think it's all about the money, in other words?
Well, they're trying to take... They're done took over some... What, ain't they? And,
yeah.
And, sir...
Well, this is my concern, too, Sam, is that in Michigan, you've got Governor Snyder, who is saying, we're going to be able to strip the right of democracy from everything from a school district to an entire township. In Ohio, you got Mitch, or in Indiana, you got Mitch Daniels bragging about the fact that he was able to break the backs of the union by stripping from them all powers for collective bargaining, and therefore 80% of the union members didn't bother to re-enroll. Why? Because their union couldn't do anything for them. You've got this battle going on in Wisconsin, which is well covered. Ohio, the state legislature, you had Republican committee chairs in both the Senate and the House saying, no, this piece of legislation is too extreme, even for me as a Republican. And the governor replaced them and went ahead with it anyway, or is going ahead with it. I mean, Sam, you're absolutely right. It is a smokescreen. It's all about stealing the country. That's what it's all about. You said it so well. Sam, thanks for the call, and thanks. It's always great to hear from you. In Albany, New York, Ed. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great. What's on your mind?
First of all, I just wanted to thank you for your support for unions. And in regards to your interview earlier about the media, I just want to make a couple comments on how the media has really been hurting this situation with the unions as far as lies and mistruths. Here in Rochester, our big newspaper is constantly flashing big headlines about union workers making $100,000 or more, you know?
Yeah.
And they won't write a story about the 85% of us. They're making $40,000 and under.
Right. And the few guys who are making over $100,000 are either senior management or people who have been working there for a long time who'd actually in the private sector make more than that because they have advanced degrees, or in some cases because there have been cutbacks in the staffing. You've got some guys who are working massive amounts of overtime, in large part because there's nobody else to do it, and overtime pays time and a half or double time given the number of hours it is, and so they end up making a fair amount of money. But it's not
A lot of those situations are that they're working in a position where there's required 24-hour coverage.
Yeah.
So and with the cutbacks and more layoffs, you're going to have one person making more and more overtime.
Sure.
And so that makes it look bad. Back in the 80s, I was in a private, and I was in the Rochester Carpenters local, and I was making about $40,000 back then. A state carpenter now, starting wage, is about $39,000.
Yeah.
So the state actually is about 20 years behind in pay.
Yeah, and not only that, there's been 20 years worth of inflation in the meantime.
Absolutely.
You know, $39,000 went a long way 20 years ago.
Another thing in this newspaper is their editorial page where you can write in letters. Now, I've written a letter a week, and I know many other union members who have written letters, and we can't get them published, but there was a letter in there the other day from a lady who complains about the state unions striking and not bargaining fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And they print that all the while knowing the strikes are illegal. We don't strike.
Yeah. Now you're in you're not in Albany, you're in Albion, New York.
I'm in Albion, New York. I was a CSEA member for 20 years.
What is the paper?
Or,
or more Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, if I could say the name. Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. Is it locally owned, or is it? You know, like when I lived in Oregon, the Oregonian was owned by a New York company.
It's a large Gannett paper.
It's owned by Gannett. So
yes.
You know, surprise, surprise, we've got a large corporation that's owning the local paper, and the local paper is
absolutely
tending to the right. Yeah. Ed, thanks
a
lot for the
point I wanted to make. Oh, okay.
Yeah, you made an excellent point, and thank you very much for the call. I'm going to try and get a whole bunch of people in here. We got a whole lot of calls. Marcia in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I want to talk about this teacher issue just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're overlooking what really should be the object lesson for these kids. It's not a matter of whether or not she has redeemed herself. Don't we want to teach these kids that no matter how bad things get, there is a way to come out of it? Look at all these teen suicides we have.
Yeah.
Because kids don't think there's any way out of whatever mess they've gotten themselves into.
You're absolutely right. Here's a woman who was the single mother of two and was homeless and worked for 8 hours in a porn film. One day, eight-hour shoot, and made a porn film. And 16 years ago. And now she has pulled herself up by her bootstraps, put herself through school, got her teacher's certificate, is teaching in the St. Louis Public School District, and the porn film surfaces, and they say, oh, we got to get rid of her. You're right. It sends the complete wrong message to the kids.
And also, we have no idea what her options were or weren't and what other resources she may or may not have had when she made that decision.
Yeah. Well, she, according to herself, she actually just takes full responsibility for it. She said, these are her words, she says, I'm a girl from the wrong side of the tracks who's made a lot of bad decisions in life, this being the most major. I wish that I could undo it more than anything in the world. And then one of the kids in her school, Daryl Rockfield, who's a junior at Parkway North High School, says, I feel really sorry for her son because he goes to the school and he's in my grade with me. And another student who's on the girls' volleyball team that this teacher coaches says, I can tell she cares about teaching her students and she really cares about us, so I don't think something she did should have an impact on what she does now. And the kids are with her.
Yeah, you know, like I say, I think that's the wrong issue.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you're right. It's the object lesson should be not just redemption. It should be you can get through this. You know, she got through this. Yeah, excellent point, Marcia. Thank you so much for sharing that. Very well said. Because we do, in fact, I was up in Vermont last weekend with some friends, and a friend of theirs had just committed suicide, a teenage kid. I mean, this is how bad it is.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And on Sunday, I was flying home, and they were going to a funeral. And it was just, it's terrible. We need to offer our kids hope.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Oh, bad news. Benedict over in the chat room says Rick Scott just undid Charlie Crist's restoration of voting rights for felons. So if you've paid your debt to society in Florida, you haven't paid your debt to society now under the new hard right Tea Party governor. Of course, the reason why is, you know, hey, they're more likely to vote for the Democrats, right? Not because they're bad people because they're felons, but because most people who find themselves as felons, particularly given our drug laws, are people who are, you know, were in poverty to begin with. And they're at the bottom of the socioeconomic ladder. So their interests tend not to lie with those of billionaires or run with those of billionaires and millionaires, which is where the Republican Party is at. So what a surprise. Barbara in Lakewood, California. Hey, Barbara, thank you for holding so long, and thanks for listening to K-Talk. What's up?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for taking my call. I have experience teaching and working in the classroom and working with troubled students. I was retired now, but I taught special education at the high school and middle school level for 31 years.
Okay.
So in terms of, there's a kind of an economic point of view or an economic issue that I kind of want to tie in a little bit in terms of, you know, a woman of, you know, this teacher being having done something of terrible moral turpitude, you know, what she chose to, you know, or the opportunity that she had to put food on the table, you know, I mean, she's probably young and in an economic situation where she was desperate.
She was. She was homeless and she was the mother of two.
Yeah. You know what? Respectable women have had gentlemen callers late at night in order to put beans in the pot. I mean, if you go back in family histories, this is a situation that is common to millions of women. And, you know, and it always has been, it always will be. So to say that someone is immoral for trying to, you know, keep their children from starving, I think is a bit hypocritical. And, it's kind of like the other end of the hedge funds, no rules, no regs. This is the microeconomic. This is a little person on the street, you know, who does what they have to do to survive. And for women, it's all, you know, usually a lot of times it involves selling your body because that's all you've got, you know, but there's that element. But in terms of, you know, of her, what it's helped her actually probably become a better teacher. And if you look at it, she is, you know, this woman has, you know, the bootstraps, pulled herself up from adversity. Mm. And, you know, hey, what are bootstraps? You do it whichever way that you have to. You know, this woman did not abandon her children. She did what she had to do at the time or what she felt she had to do. And I am sure that having gone through this adversity, she has a lot more compassion and understanding and maybe patience with some of her students who may not come from perfect backgrounds, who may have troubles. You know, so I think there's two ways of looking
at it. That's my take on it. I Googled her name, and there's all these pictures of her hugging her students and them coming to her defense and all this stuff. I mean, this is clearly a teacher whose students love her. And it's just, I think it's sad. Barbara, you were such an eloquent point, and you speak from experience. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I appreciate it. Caleb in Salem, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
Hey, you know, I wouldn't call Representative King a Nazi, but he's employing the same principles as, you know, that General Goering employed.
Well, I think a better analogy is what's his name? Joe McCarthy, Senator Joe McCarthy.
What Goering said is find an enemy, vilify him, and call everyone who doesn't agree with you a traitor, and this appears to be the game plan.
Yeah. Well, Peter King has been doing this for a long, long time. And hopefully in this case, and well said, Caleb, thank you. Hopefully in this case he has overstepped. We shall see. We shall see. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah, I just had a comment about the teacher who did porn, and probably the people who are calling for her firing the most are probably so-called Christians. And isn't you talked about redemption, but isn't forgiveness one of the tenets of Christianity? And you know, these are the same people, you know, so-called Christians. They come to the defense of people like Ted Haggard or Jimmy Swaggart or Jim Baker, and they, you know, when they get
Newt Gingrich
sex scandals. Yeah, and you know, not only do they not distance themselves or condemn them, they keep giving them money. You know, so you know, there's a hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The previous caller made a good point. You know, they go after the little guy; they don't go after the big guys like the Swaggarts. You know, all these millionaires.
Yeah, and you know, one of Jesus's more famous parables, or not parables, events in his life. Is you know, he was walking along the road or whatever with his disciples, and they came upon this woman who was about to be stoned as a prostitute by a group of men who were going to stone her, who had convicted her of prostitution.
Yeah.
And Jesus walked up to them and kind of stopped it, and they were rather quite upset with him about that, and so he said to them, okay, go ahead, do it, stone her to death. Let he who is without sin among you throw the first stone. And one by one, they set down the stones and walked away in shame.
Yeah. Lost lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. And you would think that people who claim to subscribe to that religion would say, yeah, okay, I remember that story. Maybe I should learn something from it. Oh, so far. So far, not. But we'll see. I, you know, maybe she'll have a good shot this time. In any case, the website, I want to defendwisconsin.org is the website. I want to plug it one more time so you can check it out and help out the folks in Wisconsin. All the latest news on what's going on in Wisconsin, the road to recall, recall the 8 Wisconsin Republican senators. I'm looking at it here right now. defendwisconsin.org. And of course, this is just a microcosm of the macrocosm. If you're in Michigan, get down to the Lansing, etc., and show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.